U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Democrats blame inflation on corporate greed and price gouging as Chicago teachers reach a deal to reopen school. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, columnist Kim Strassel and editorial writer Jason Willick. New inflation figures are coming out Wednesday from the Labor Department, and that will be the consumer price index data for the Christmas month of December. But the figure for November, of course, just to review, was up 6.8% year over year. That includes 6.4% for the category food at home, 12.8% on meat, poultry, fish, and eggs, and 25% on natural gas. And so the context for the new figures coming out tomorrow, Kim, is this push by Democrats and the Biden administration to blame inflation on market failures, corporate greed. Last week, the White House had a virtual meeting to discuss competition in the meat processing industry. President Biden said that there are four corporations that control more than half of the markets in beef, poultry, and pork. And then he said this.
Without meaningful competition, farmers and ranchers don't get to choose who they sell to. Or put another way, our farmers and ranchers have to pay whatever these four big companies say they have to pay, by and large. But that's only half of it. These companies can use their position as middlemen to overcharge grocery stores and ultimately families.
Kim, what do you make of that? This idea that this meatflation we're seeing is caused by the scoundrels at Big Meat.
To be clear, meatflation is certainly a real thing. And if you have been to a meat counter lately, and I am a huge meat eater, it's been real sticker shock. But this is the oldest play in the Democratic playbook whenever it comes to rising prices, which is to blame big companies. And in this particular case, they see a double benefit in that they can try to put the blame on these four large producers and also put themselves on the side of the average rancher and farmer who, as you just heard from the president, they claim can't have any competition in who they decide to sell to, and also on the side of obviously consumers. The problem with this, as always, is that it just simply ignores the market, the basic fundamental principles of supply and demand. And what we're seeing right now is that meat packers, and these four big companies, are seeing huge demand for their product, which was pent up. People, lots of transfer payments for government, they've got money, and yet severe labor shortages, which means that they can't get enough packed to actually meet all of that demand. And as everyone knows, whoever sat down in Econ 101, when you have a supply and demand mismatch like that, prices go up.
Another example that struck me was from Elizabeth Warren. And in December, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren wrote letters to some grocery chains, including Publix and Kroger. Here's part of what she said. I'm writing regarding my concerns about rising grocery prices for American consumers and the extent to which large grocery retailers are earning massive profits for company officials and investors while making it harder for American families to put food on the table, unquote. And Jason, the reason that that example specifically stuck out to me was because the grocery business and retailing more generally are brutal, brutal businesses to be in with thin profit margins. A lot of players going in and out, grocery stores open, grocery stores closed. There's no lack of competition in the grocery business. And so the idea that rising food prices are Kroger's fault, I find hard to take.
Yeah. During coronavirus, there's two aspects, as Kim mentioned. There's the supply side and the demand side. The demand side, there's been transfer payments that have increased the amount of money consumers have to spend. On the supply side, there have been restrictions by the government on people's ability to work, restrictions caused by fear of the virus. But the Democratic messaging has, of course, had to support its large transfer and stimulus bills. And it's been supporting the virus-related restrictions. So if your sort of ideological commitments are going to lead to rising prices, you have to have another alternative. And the alternative we're apparently seeing is corporate greed and competition. But You know, even Larry Summers, the Democratic economist, said a little after Christmas, the emerging claim that antitrust can combat inflation reflects science denial. There are many areas like transitory inflation where serious economists differ. Antitrust as an anti-inflation strategy is not one of them. So, I mean, it's just, you know, it's not serious. The inflation is being driven by other things related to the virus and the recovery. And this is scapegoating to try to bully business into helping Democrats politically.
And outside of the food business, I think the issues are similar. They're broad issues, not these specific issues that the Biden administration wants to raise. And another one I'll point to as an example is energy. Last week, there were 41 Democratic members of Congress who wrote a letter to energy regulators. And here's part of what they said. We urge the commission to use its existing regular authority to ensure that households' energy bills are not driven up by manipulation, obfuscation, and other malfeasance. And Kim, again, the idea that there are forecasts that average Americans are going to be paying more to heat their homes this winter, and the idea that the reason for that is that these energy companies just suddenly became extra greedy in the last 3 or 6 months. I mean, who do they expect to believe that?
Well, they're hoping the American public. It's interesting when you look at that letter that those 41 Democrats sent. They cited an underlying document from the Energy Information Administration, noting that average Americans are going to spend 30% more this winter than they did last winter on natural gas, those who use it as a heating fuel. But apparently, the Democrats only read half of the letter, because if you go on, the EIA explains why this is. He said the problem is that fuel demand has increased from recent lows faster than production. Again, it's a supply-demand mismatch, and in this case, exacerbated by the Biden administration, which has made very clear, sent the signal to industry, that it would love nothing more than to phase out U.S. fossil fuel production, which discourages producers from making new investments. We've had the cancellation of pipelines. Just this week, I would note, the federal government under the Biden administration is moving to wall off 11 million acres on the North Slope of Alaska to new oil and gas leases. They want to revert back to a plan that existed in the Obama administration. The Trump team had moved to open up the National Petroleum Reserve. By the way, that name is telling. It was actually set aside for oil and gas development in the 1920s. And the Trump administration had moved to open more of it up to that purpose. Now they're moving to scale it back again. And, you know, this is the same administration that, even as it's shutting down all of these potential projects in the United States, which is factoring in to prices, it's begging OPEC to produce more oil. And this is just a disconnect, a mismatch that they really need to be called on.
Yeah, what I would add to that on the natural gas side is just the difficulty of building any new infrastructure, especially these natural gas pipelines that are supposed to get the product people use to heat their homes where it needs to go. And there were two recent pipelines that won Supreme Court cases, the U.S. Supreme Court. They won challenges. And then shortly afterward, both of them were canceled anyway because the developers knew there were other roadblocks that were being thrown up and it wasn't worth the effort. And so, Jason, that's what I mean when I say the supply and demand mismatch coming out of the pandemic is the same for a lot of these categories, where the economy is starting to roll again. There are labor shortages, and so it's harder for people to get products, for companies to get their products out the door and on shelves. But there are also some specific issues, too, that the Biden administration on energy has played a role in creating the supply hangups that we're now seeing the inflation as a result of.
Right. If it's brazen to blame the grocery stores for food prices, I mean, we need another word for the Biden administration blaming natural gas, when they, of course, are choking off natural gas production. And the other policy contribution, of course, has been, as Kim mentioned, the stimulus bills that put more money into the economy and increased demand more than was expected.
So, Kim, what do you think Democrats are doing here? And you look at the polls of consumers, the public, people are really concerned about inflation. They're very concerned about the economy. Some polls show concern about the economy matching or higher now than COVID. I mean, do they really think that they can sustain this theory that corporate greed is responsible for inflation all the way through the November elections?
what else do they have? I think that's their political problem, is that, as you mentioned, this has now grown to be one of the top concerns for Americans, in many polls, even outranking things like COVID. And we just pointed out all of the reasons behind this, the supply-demand mismatch. And so you have an administration hell-bent on a stronger regulatory agenda, which is a signal to companies out there to pull back, to not invest, to not expand, to not do more. You have labor shortages that are caused by these transfer payments, in part because people are being paid to not go to work. You have money that is still flowing into households also from those transfer payments that is stoking demand. So the answer to inflation is to really invest in the supply side, to pull back on those regulations, to encourage businesses to grow and expand. That would, you know, if you really wanted to send a great signal, offer some sort of tax cuts to really help the business community. The Biden administration's entire agenda is opposite to that. So it's not going to embrace the actual policy fixes that would do something to help with inflation. And instead, it's just going to peddle this bogus claim that this is all the fault of companies and that it had nothing to do with it. I don't know that Americans are going to buy it. And it kind of doesn't matter even if they buy it or not, because what tends to really infuriate Americans are just those higher prices, and they don't really care who is to blame. The political axe is going to fall on Democrats because they're in charge unless they figure out a way to actually ease some of these prices.
Well, one last thought on this. The November year-over-year figure, that was the latest we have, is 6.8%. And tomorrow we're supposed to get the December year-over-year figure. Jason, do you think if it's lower than 6.8%, or if it starts to moderate here in a couple months, you know, maybe we hit 5% or 4%, do you think Biden administration will say that, see, this is transitory, nothing to worry about here, folks, and say that what they're doing is working?
I'm sure they're crossing their fingers for a lower figure than 6.8%. You know, Kim mentioned some of the things they could do. Another thing they could do is sort of send a message that we're ready to go back to normal in terms of the coronavirus. Rochelle Walensky probably helped in this regard when the CDC changed its testing, its quarantine guidelines, so workers don't need to quarantine for as long. And in fact, Fauci and others explicitly said that this had to do with the economic impact of these quarantines, of course, on squeezing supply of workers and therefore increasing prices. But I think, you know, Kim's right. If you were serious about inflation, you'd take a different regulatory approach. You'd take a different virus approach. You maybe wouldn't have renominated Jay Powell, who presided over the inflation that he said would be transitory and that wasn't. I think they're certainly hoping for a downward tick in inflation, and we haven't seen, unfortunately, from this administration, any more willingness to admit error than in the Trump administration. So I think they'll be doubling down on their message no matter what happens.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Another big news story today is a deal in Chicago. Mayor Lori Lightfoot has announced a bargain with the Chicago Teachers Union to reopen schools after about a week of missed in-person classes. And Kim, we don't have all the details of this bargain yet, but I'm reading from a story in the Chicago Sun-Times. It says the district will stick with an opt-in testing, will increase student testing and vaccination to 100% by February 1st. The school district also agreed to shut down a building for 5 days if 30% or more of its teachers are absent for two consecutive days because of positive cases or quarantines. So it looks like there are some thresholds that are being built in here for if COVID cases get really out of hand. Here's another one. A school would close if 40% of its students were quarantining. Kim, what do you make of this as an exercise in union political power here?
Well, it's exercise in union political power that seems to have succeeded, in that if you read these stories closely, What's pretty clear is that the headlines that say kids are going to be returning to school in Chicago are not entirely accurate, in that by the time you layer on all of these different things that they are demanding before a school actually reopens, whether it's staff absences or vaccine levels or students in quarantine or isolation, or whether or not there's another one, there's a period of high community COVID-19 transmission that's also in there, which obviously is what's happening at the moment. You may not have many kids really back in school after all. And then one other thing I would add to this, this is simply an agreement by the Chicago Teachers Union's House of Delegates, which is their kind of steering committee, as it were, to move ahead. It still faces a union rank and file vote this week. And that was obviously the group of people that were so adamant not to return in the first place. So we'll see who actually goes back to school or even whether they open at all. This has been very stunning to a lot of parents. It's become a national story because it is just showing the degree to which unions are putting their desire to not work ahead of kids and everything else. It's not happening in many other places around the country, at least not to this degree. But after 2 years of COVID, it's really highlighting the problem with union power and their ability to just completely shut down education.
But at what point does that run out during this pandemic, Jason? I mean, we all know that the risk of COVID to anyone who is under 18, who's in these schools, is very, very low. And also, for the teachers, for everyone working in the school, vaccines have been available for a long, long time. There's no longer supply constrictions on them. We're not in January of 2021 or October of 2020 anymore. And so at what point do you think that normalcy returns to some of these schools?
The unions have, you know, exerted a huge amount of control over education for a long time, and I hope this will be the straw that breaks the camel's back, but I can't say I'm certain because they've been able to make a lot of outrageous demands before. Illinois has laws that favor unions' political power. And one other question I just would say that this raises is the last COVID relief bill, the $1.9 trillion bill passed earlier this year, gave, I think, over $120 billion to schools under the promise that this would help schools stay open and stay open safely. But apparently not. Apparently, the schools are going to continue to have these staggered shutdowns anyway.
But one thing that seems to have changed, at least to my mind, is the tone of the leadership in some of these cities. In a previous episode, I think we had a clip from Mayor Eric Adams saying that kids are safest at school. And Mayor Larry Lightfoot in Chicago is saying similar things. Here's her on NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday.
What the Chicago Teachers Union did was an illegal walkout. They abandoned their posts and they abandoned kids and their families.
Kim, that is pretty strong rhetoric from a Democratic politician about a teachers union.
Yes, and it's a reflection of the blowback that a lot of these mayors and school boards are getting around the country from parents who at this point are completely fed up. And it's an indication that those Democrats are very worried about electoral fallout if they don't do something about this situation. It was notable that the mayor called this an illegal walkout. And that's very interesting. As a question of legality, that's unclear. Some people are still digging into that. What seems beyond doubt is that this is a violation of contractual obligations. You know, teachers don't just get to walk out. And, you know, what you really wish is that you have some sort of moment in which the school board, the mayor, somebody took action and said, get back to school or your position is at risk. Now that in theory would cause more havoc in the short term in terms of hiring new people, et cetera. But you either have to get tough with these folks in terms of administration or you have to get tough with them at the ballot box. And I think that the problem for these politicians is that they're worried that they are going to be the ones to suffer the political repercussions if they can't get things moving again.
Yeah, and I guess I would close with just a bit of pessimism. I think the rhetoric changing from some of these politicians is noteworthy for sure. But especially in a state like Illinois, I find it harder to imagine what kind of reforms could pass the legislature there. I mean, you think of something in Wisconsin like Scott Walker's Act 10, which had changes to collective bargaining. It's hard for me to imagine that passing in Illinois, Jason, but maybe I'm being too pessimistic, or maybe there's a ballot referendum way that some of these things can get before voters in some of these states instead of having to go through the legislatures.
Yeah, no, that's exactly my reason for pessimism as well. It's one thing for Lori Lightfoot to talk tough right now. It's another thing for the legislature to reform the collective bargaining rules, to pare back some of the legal protections that the teachers unions can exploit. You know, when Scott Walker tried to do it, as you said, you know, the Wisconsin's Capitol was occupied by, you know, I mean, it was just mayhem, huge Democratic resistance for abandoning teachers and so on. So, and, you know, I would add that we haven't seen the White House weigh in too strongly on this either. So I certainly hope that this breathes some life into these campaigns to reform the public sector, not just teachers' unions, by the way. I mean, we've seen issues with prison guards, correctional officers not going in. You know, there's a lot of, like any other employees, you know, we talked at the beginning about the supply side problem with employees not being able to work. It's much more pronounced in the public sector. And I sure hope that there will be reform, but I think it's a heavy lift in a place like Illinois.
Thank you, Jason and Kim. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. And if you like the show, please hit that subscribe button on your favorite podcast app. Also, stay tuned later this month when episodes will be available 5 days a week. But until then, we'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.